You're listening to the MoneyWeb SAFM Market Update Podcast.
Off the back of the B20 summit that kicked off today in lead up to the G20 leaders gathering that will be taking place over the weekend, I had the privilege of taking a walk through the B20 summit and being part of some of the conversations that took place today. Certainly a landmark summit and a historic moment for South Africa on the world stage. We're going to get some thoughts and reflections around this from a very special guest, a gentleman who was there for the first G20 summit ever to take place way back in September of 1999. At the time, he would have been the first Democratic Finance Minister of the Republic of South Africa. Today, you might know him as the chair of the African Expert Panel for the G20. I'm, of course, referring to the Honourable Mr. Trevor Manuel, who joins me on the line now to take a look at some G20 and B20 reflections. Uncle Trevor, thank you so much for taking the time. Lovely to have you on our show. I guess let's start our conversation with your memories of the first G20 summit that took place. As someone who has the benefit of having been part of the first one ever and now part of the first African one, surely you must have some fond memories and fond reflections?
Well, for the record, Jimmy, if we are looking that far back, then this is not the first African summit. We hosted the G20, which was then made up of finance ministers and central bank governors, in 2007 at Claremont in the Western Cape. But the first summit was actually convened in the wake of an American set of events. A hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management went belly up and it knocked the financial sector in the US in 1998. And it occasioned the convening of countries that were deemed to be systemically significant to the global financial system. South Africa was deemed to be amongst those countries, and that's why we were included. And we then looked at what the consequences would be. At that time, there were a number of events that caused contagion. There was there'd been the Asian, the so-called tequila collapse in 1994. There were various Asian crises in the late 90s. There was also an Indonesian financial crisis just before this LTCM. And so the idea was that countries need to convene, look at the issues, understand what was going on, and take decisions towards crisis prevention. And that continued, and so it was relatively uneventful until 2007, when the start of the Great Recession, when again there were major problems in the United States resulting from collateralized debt obligations and a mortgage system that actually had thrown credit at anything that moved, and it was completely unaffordable. The rating agencies had rated those instruments as AAA, and the crisis was profound. We were in Washington for the annual meetings in October of 2008, when we were called to a brief meeting late one night, when then President George W. Bush said that he needs to convene the heads of state to talk about the nature of the crisis. And the following month, which would be November of 2008, there was a meeting convened at the White House, which was the first formal meeting of the G20 that involved heads of state also. At that point, there was no money. There was complete crisis, complete pandemonium in the Northern Hemisphere. And work was done, and then heads of state and finance ministers were convened in London on the 2nd of April 2009, by which time there'd been a change of president in the United States. Barack Obama had become president of the U.S., and there was then the question of how the world was going to be bailed out. And the one country that actually had resources to do it was China. And China had a very small shareholding of the IMF. Their shareholding was in fact equivalent to that of Belgium, but they didn't stand on ceremony. They looked at the situation, they availed resources and said, we will deal with this problem when the time is right to do so. And that was a big, big turning point. And from then, the G20 changed from just finance ministers to include heads of state and government. And so that was quite a significant... It's interesting that the change happened because of certain difficulties in the U.S., as had been the case a decade before, when long-term capital management proved not to be so long-term after all. And that's the kind of origins of this matter. And since then, more and more issues were added to the life of the G20, so that now it's a pretty complex set of issues. But what has not changed is that you've got a troika of countries. You have the current chairperson, supported by the previous chairperson and the incoming chairperson. Those three countries form a troika. They agree, they persuade each other on matters, and that is the epicenter of what will drive the G20 forward. It has never been broken, but at the present time, we don't know what will happen to the incoming G20 presidency that ought to be the United States of America.
Uncle Trevor, we'll come back to the United States picture and what that means for the G20 at the moment. Can we just get a sense of what the importance of the G20 is in today's world? We live in a very globalized world. We live in a world where the likes of the Chinas that you've mentioned, the United States, Europe, Africa, every country, every continent cannot exist without collaborating with other parties. How then does something like the G20 in its current form, taking place for the first time on the African soil, become ever so important for those global relationships?
Jimmy, the relationship between countries, economic relationships between countries, is fundamentally important. Largely, it is a set of relationships that's managed in some shape or form by the World Bank and IMF and, of course, the World Trade Organization. It's contested territory, and it's because nothing is cut and dried. The rules are made up as you go along. There are also other organizations like the Bank for International Settlements, which is based in Switzerland. And these organizations together try and define the rules for the interaction between countries. The presumption is that what happens within countries is a matter for elected governments. And so it's in respect of these rules that you need the platform that the G20 provides. Bear in mind that prior to the G20, there was always the G7. At one time, it expanded to the G8 to include Russia. And Russia was kicked out again, and it's back to that. It's back to the G7, but it lost its influence. At the same time, there's a group of countries where South Africa sits perhaps more uncomfortably, which is the BRICS. It's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, now expanded as well. But these countries also talk through common issues. But if you look at the G20. The big issue is that it accounts for almost 90% of the world's total output and a very high percentage of the world's total population. So it is the largest coordinating center of economic activity across the globe. Trying to get these systems to work in sync is a big mission and a wonderful opportunity to advance these matters. But the one thing that it does need is absolute good faith, because you can't decide on rules for everything. So the ability of people of equal stature, central bank governors or finance ministers or heads of state, to be able to talk to each other, look each other in the eye, resolve these matters, is the one way of dealing with challenges as and when they arise. There's no substitute for it. The larger, the more influential the group, the easier it is to find solutions. That has been what has happened. That's what has grown out of the early beginnings of the G20 to where it is now.
Uncle Trevor, as someone with the experience that you have, having served South Africa at the highest of levels and representing South Africa at many an international stage, I want to get your thoughts on the US developments. We are not strangers to heads of states not attending events. We have seen this happen in the past before, but the current tensions between South Africa and the United States and the comments being made out of Washington, particularly related to the G20 and understanding that we have to hand over the presidency to the United States, and the United States has elected to not be part of our G20, so to speak. I want to get your thoughts on what that does for global relationships, what that does for just the collaboration that we're aiming to foster within the G20 states. I mean, you touched on this at the start of our conversation, saying that South Africa was a member from the very beginning, despite what Washington is alleging that we were added on after the fact. How do we navigate the current situation, understanding that even beyond the end of this year and this presidency of the G20, we might still have to find a way to work together?
Jimmy, I mean, the point about South Africa and the G20 is we haven't done anything to cause the collapse of the global economy. That is true. That's it's plain for everybody to see. The U.S. cannot quite make the same claim. The problem here is that it's the faith and the trust that is broken. We don't know how it will be fixed. There is a wonderful editorial in The Economist of this week, The Economist magazine of this week, that talks about 2025 being the end of the world that we've known. And if I move back from that statement, the world that we've known has grown up after World War II, when leaders saw the horrors of war. Many of them had been around, though not in leadership positions, in World War I, saw what happened between World War I and World War II, and thought that it's best to establish institutions for the prevention of war and for the advancement of economic prosperity. So during 1945, heads of state and government set about establishing the United Nations organization, and they also set about to establish a International Bank for Reconstruction Development, or the World Bank, if you must. And then they also set about establishing an institution dealing with balance of payments difficulties in countries, the International Monetary Fund. So those are the three institutions. At the time of that conference, it was actually a fourth institution that didn't get off the ground for many, many decades, and that was called the International Trade Organization, and didn't get off the ground because Senate in the United States said that it is their responsibility to determine tariffs, and if you have an outside agency, it'll be diminishing the responsibilities of the U.S. Senate. But the organizations were started and set about trying to establish good order in the affairs between states. The U.N. at inception reached certain agreements. With the benefit of hindsight, some of them weren't so smart. If I think of the Security Council, especially the part that deals with the veto states in the Security Council, then it may have been a child of its time, but it's a massive power given to the countries who are permanent members of the Security Council. But it was a moment in time kind of decision, because those were the countries that were the victors of World War II. The IMF and World Bank also agreed on some shareholding. And bear in mind that South Africa was there from the Bretton Woods institutions, two being founding shareholders of the World Bank and IMF. And so it's a long-standing relationship. And you've got to examine how these organizations run. But that's, I suppose, the architecture of the interrelationship between states.
Uncle Trevor, before I let you go, as a parting thought, how do we move forward? You mentioned that we might not have all the answers and all the solutions, but surely we have some idea of how we move conversations like the G20 forward into what could potentially be a new world if we are to hold the assumption that 2025 brings the end of what we know it at the moment. If we are to have a new way of working, a new way of collaborating, a new way of sharing between countries, how then do we position this G20 to be fundamental towards that?
Well, it's a very hard call, because you may need to kind of construct a relationship with a bit of leapfrogging over the incoming chair if they are that disinterested, because my own sense is that the G20 is far too big a project to abandon because of the unpredictable announcements by a single country. In fact, a few weeks ago, they were going to send their deputy president, and now he and every other official of the U.S. administration has been withdrawn. You can't take decisions on that basis. Every textbook will tell you that policymaking requires certainty and predictability. And what we are seeing from the U.S. right now is everything that is antithetical to certainty and predictability. Whether this be in trade talks, in their participation in the G20, in their relationships with the United Nations, or any other relations with those parts of the world that are not the U.S., it's all based on the mood swings of the president and particularly individuals, and I would submit that that is not a good basis for decision making about world affairs.
If we are to chart forward a world that can coexist, we need to think about how we do that, and we need to think about the importance of conversations like the G20. That is the message that is being shared, at least the perspective of the chairperson of the Africa Expert Panel at this year's G20, Mr. Trevor Manuel. Thank you so much for joining us to take a look at the G20, its importance in today's world, and how we navigate this year's summit.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb SAFM Market Update podcast, uploaded weekdays at 7 p.m. For more MoneyWeb podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.